This is PodTech News Weekly Magazine for Saturday, November 11th, 2006. I'm Jason Lopez.
Something happened this year where all of a sudden video became a fundamental data type on the internet, and we want to be part of that. The underlying draw of being able to see what people are doing, have computers suggest adjacent or related kinds of videos, is a whole new paradigm, and one that's important for end users.
The hottest ticket in San Francisco last week was the Web 2.0 Summit, where some big names in the internet world showed up, like Eric Schmidt, Barry Diller, Jeff Bezos, Bruce Chizen, Mark Andreessen. Even Mary Meeker showed up. Yes, that Mary Meeker. On the other side of the bay, down south in San Jose, the Dow Jones Consumer Electronics Conference entertained its own luminaries in the video on the web crowd. And Rio Pacino looks at the PlayStation 3, set to be released next week. Those stories here on PodTech News Weekly Magazine. It's Saturday, November 11th, 2006. I'm Jason Lopez for PodTech News. If you're addicted to watching videos on websites like YouTube or MySpace, antivirus companies want to have a word with you, and that word is beware. It seems that hackers and high-tech criminals have found a new way to put their malware on your laptop or desktop. That's right, through videos, or more precisely, the applications you need to play those videos. PodTech's Clark Boyd explains.
Most web video and audio files are so big that they have to be compressed in order to upload and download them effectively. Now, when you watch those compressed videos on your machine, you usually need something called a codec. To find out more, I called Shane Corson, senior technical consultant at Kaspersky Labs, an antivirus company. I reached Shane on his cell phone. He started by telling me what a codec is and what it's good for.
Codec is basically a video player, for lack of a better definition of it. It is able to take a video file, which is really just a big, huge data file, and decode that file in such a way that it actually plays back on your computer as a video or as audio file.
Shane has bad news for you video and audio fans. It seems that hackers are writing their own malicious code into codecs, and then the hackers go out of their way to entice you into downloading those infected codecs.
They want to gain your interest. They want to get you to their website. Once you're at their website, you want to look at that video that they have up, or the audio file, or really any application that they have posted there. And so, thinking that video files, it's just a big data file, it can't affect my computer, you go ahead and click on it. Once you click on that video file, another message may pop up. You need to have a codec. You need to have this specific codec, as a matter of fact, and here you can download it right from this website. So the people download the codec, and unbeknownst to them, it's actually a Trojanized application. Yes, it does play the video ultimately, but it also does other things on their system, like opening up backdoors.
And once those backdoors are open, they can put all kinds of malware onto your machine. Adware, ransomware, Trojans, keystroke loggers. You name it, they'll try to put it on your machine, says Graham Cluley of the British-based antivirus company Sophos.
Anything malicious, really. It could be a virus or a worm or a piece of spyware which steals information from your computer. We've also seen adware as well. So you install a codec and you begin to get really irritating pop-up messages occurring all the time, trying to get you to buy something. In the cases of other codecs, we've seen instances where once you're viewing the video, maybe it's working absolutely splendidly, and then you get a message saying, oh, you know, your computer's been determined to be infected by malicious code, and it says in order to clean up, go and buy this product to clean yourself up. You go and spend your $30 online to buy a product which cleans you up, and it actually turned out you were never infected at all, other than by the codec. So it's what we call a sort of scareware, where it's scaring you into thinking you have a security problem when you don't, in order to make you make a purchase. So all kinds of unpleasantness.
Well, I'm just thinking with the popularity of video right now, it seems like sort of the ideal medium to try to get into your computer, really.
It is a good method. I mean, things like YouTube haven't really suffered from these kind of attacks. the YouTube guys, I think they're using what's known as a flash codec, if I remember correctly, in order to view their items. So you normally wouldn't have to download anything new to watch the videos there. But if you're downloading movies and other material from other websites, which do require you to download an additional codec, then you might get yourself into trouble. And the problem is that talking about things like codecs, it gets really nerdy and geeky. And the average guy now who's using a computer may not be able to understand all these technical terms, and trying to get them to understand that, you know, they have to take a little bit of care as to where they get their codec from and where they find their videos is obviously hard.
It sounds like a whole new public information campaign now that you have to go out and do.
It's always, I mean, we've struggled for years in the antivirus business just to get the most basic computer safety education out to the masses. So trying to now get into the realms of codecs and videos, I think it's actually just far too complicated for the average guy in the street to really be able to understand and handle.
Well, I wonder, too, we're obviously seeing this come in through the codec right now, but I wonder if we're going to see in the future, do you think, the actual malicious code coming in through the audio or video itself?
Well, the only way in which that would happen would be if there were a vulnerability or a bug in your media player. So it's unlikely that that would happen, but I'm afraid if you remember, about 11 months ago, at the end of 2005, there was a serious flaw in Microsoft Windows in the way it handled graphic files, a file format called WMF, which are a bit like JPEGs or GIF files, so a commonly used file format. And unfortunately, there was a bug in Microsoft's code, which meant just viewing a WMF file could infect you with a virus because of an exploit which the hackers could take advantage of. Now, if they found similar exploits in movie files and audio files, they could potentially install malware that way as well onto your computer. Now, we're not aware of any exploits at the moment which allow them to do that, but there is that potential in the future. But I wouldn't lose too much sleep about it if I was a regular computer user at the moment. Just keep your protection up to date with your security patches and, of course, your antivirus software.
I wonder, too, Graham, what you think the responsibility of big video providers is when it comes to stuff like this. What do they need to do to help their users stay safe?
Well, I certainly think that that those websites which are hosting videos, and I say YouTube is a classic example, and I think they're doing a good job, but you know, the onus is upon them to secure their users and their visitors, I think, and to warn them. So they should be checking any videos which are posted, not only to see if they contain malicious content, but also unsavory content. Also, you know, to make sure that what's being posted is legal. That's another big issue with these internet video sites, is whether everything that's been posted up is legal, both from the sort of pornographic point of view, but also the copyright point of view as well.
And Graham, just one last question. Since we're on the topic of viruses here, what are we seeing out there on the horizon that's giving you guys pause right now?
Well, there's all kinds of things going on. We've seen this real growth in terms of spyware and phishing during the course of the year. So phishing malware, which waits for you to log into online banks and then grabs your username and password. We saw just earlier today in our labs a brand new piece of malware for Mac OS X called the Macarena virus, of all things, which isn't going to spread in the wild, but it's certainly an interesting proof of concept that people are playing around trying to write things like that. I mean, we saw something like 4,000 new viruses and Trojan horses in the course of the last month. So the problem certainly hasn't gone away. And as I said earlier, people really need to secure their systems, not only with firewalls and security patches and antivirus software, but also with a really good helping, a good dollop of common sense when it comes to how they use the internet. Because there are a lot of people out there who are trying to infect you and cause problems.
Graham, thanks a lot.
Cheers, Clark.
By the way, I also asked Shane Corson of Kaspersky Labs what he thought the most pressing virus problem was these days. He pointed toward the growing criminalization of the global hacking community.
We are seeing a number of specifically Trojan applications that are being written specifically for the purpose of stealing data, confidential data, that can then be used to, for example, steal identities, get into people's bank accounts. The guys that used to do this stuff, the guys that used to write the malware, the simple little viruses, are no longer the, you know, average 14, 15-year-old kid with a computer who's bored over summer vacation. These are 20 and 30-something-year-olds, groups of them that have actually formed businesses that are intent on stealing our confidential data to make a profit from it.
Here's a fact to leave you with. By some estimates, spam alone will cost businesses and consumers worldwide more than $190 billion in 2007. Think about that the next time you click on the dancing polar bear clip on YouTube. In Boston, this is Clark Boyd for Podtech News.
Let's turn our attention to events. First, we go to the Web 2.0 Summit held last week in San Francisco. Reporter Catherine Girardeau learned about Web 2.0 spam, fuzzy logic, network neutrality, and why the chicken crossed the road.
It's a real change in the paradigm.
And I think you'll also see more people cross over from basic user-generated video creators to, you know, prosumers, where they're actually spending time creating a video that might actually get seen by millions of people and make them some cash.
So we're most excited at the moment about Amazon's S3 and their Elastic Computing model. And as a way just to scale up, rather than buying our own infrastructure and building our own data center for storing things or computing things, try to use
that. There are a lot of rights issues involved.
Part of me is the company.
Fuzzy logic is the logic of gray shaded areas. You know, in life, everything is gray shade.
Well, in some respects, network neutrality has been important to the Internet ever since its inception.
The opportunity to scale. All of the infrastructure has come together now so that people have access to broadband, fast PCs. What that means for a company like mine is that, you know, we have access to customers.
Everybody would like to believe that their entrails are of great interest to everybody. It's just... probably not so.
The feeling that you get when you have 40 people all working together and you take something down is the kind of feeling that you get when you have an ensemble, you have a musical moment when everything just sort of happens and works right. And there's a certain kind of bonding, there's a certain kind of learning, there's a certain kind of imagination that happens.
Google is now the largest business partner of the New York Times Company.
I'm part of this blogging world 24 hours a day.
This is Catherine Girardeau at the Web 2.0 Summit in San Francisco's Palace Hotel. You're hearing the sounds of web search as interpreted by Hakia. Hakia is an upstart search engine company based in New York City. Founded by nuclear scientist and artificial intelligence expert Dr. Riza Birkin, it's a new kind of search engine using semantics and the context of words used in searches to produce deeper, more relevant results, the founder says, than the indexing method used by most other search engines. Birkin is not your average Web 2.0 entrepreneur. He's thinking, at this point anyway, less about marketing and monetization and more about, well, fuzzy logic. He's even written a book on the topic.
Mathematics is based on the idealism of black and white. In mathematics, something is either true or false. But in real life, nothing is really 100% true or 100% false. So the fuzzy logic is a new mathematics, so to speak, that starts to take into account those uncertainties in the gray shaded areas. And it applies wonderfully to language, because language is very fuzzy in so many ways. When you say something, you may mean something else. And when you mean something, you may be saying something else. It's just the different notions of language is wonderfully fit to the fuzzy logic paradigm.
Got that? Good. Okay, let's get down to brass tacks for a moment. Melek Polatkanak, Hakia's chief operating officer.
Hakia was founded in 2004, but solving the problem has been a longer process for the founders. Riza has been thinking about it for 10 years. Dr. Raskin has been working about it for 40. So they have been thinking for a half a century. And then we started, you know, coding and decided to break from indexing in 2004. We have funding from institutional and angel investors. And year to date, we raised $11 million.
That's a healthy amount of funding. But Birkin said Hakia doesn't intend to compete with the likes of Google or Yahoo.
We are here to expand horizons. We are here to gain new users into web search, professionals, researchers, and people who have more complicated queries, and people who don't really go to web search engines because those complicated queries are never awarded.
How exactly do you use semantics to get to more relevant search results? Birkin gives a high-level explanation.
The most important thing that we bring into the market is that, first of all, to deploy full semantic system without any compromise, we quickly realized that we had to give up the indexing system. Because indexing is like a balloon. It gets inflated each time it absorbs a page, and that's not the way to deploy full semantic analysis. Semantic analysis requires a lot of enrichment, and there's no really space.
So basically, from what I understand, the way your search engine works is different, because if I type in a search query or a search string, somehow the search engine can try to discern what it is I'm really looking for, even if I didn't quite express it clearly. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct. And we call it the semantic rank algorithm. Depends on understanding your taste, understanding your wishes. So we have a layer there that understands what really you mean by, for instance, when you say why is the sky blue? Why did Enron fail? Why did this? Why did that? We immediately understand you are looking for a cause and reason.
Now, let's just get back to that music for a second.
Now, I found something really fun on your website, which is some really crazy music that supposedly was created somehow based on the same rhythms of a search. Is this bogus?
No, it's real.
Scientific? Can you explain?
Most of the core team members turn out to be musicians in one way or another, so we... Those days when we were too tired of thinking search, so we started playing some music together. And in the process, this idea came up, why don't we just create so-called search music? What we do, we do a web search. So we find something interesting, some interesting lyric that's not copyrighted or anything like that. So we compose around it. And why did the chicken cross the road was one of those queries that we searched, and whatever we found, we composed the music around it.
How do you compose music around a web search?
I don't know. I think the listeners must decide on that.
I think maybe you have to be a nuclear scientist to do this.
There are many people contributed to that.
You have to be a nuclear scientist and working very hard to type a query like, why did the chicken cross the road?
What we wanted to make is we wanted to make it a new music style. We have different instruments to symbolize the variations of cultural makeup of the entire internet. And also the simplicity of the music is kind of, in a way, symbolizes the simplicity of accessing that knowledge and surfing on the internet. So there are actually like some computer sounds in the background, if you heard them. That's the fun part of it. And, it gets so tiring sometimes, so we have to enjoy ourselves.
It is a straight, flat band made of a material that the Cimmerians call asphalt, which in the Cimmerian language means asphalt.
The Web 2.0 Summit ranged from the extremes of algorithmical exploration to the more predictable conference pursuits, networking, warehawking, and idea mashups. Almost every hallway and conference room at the Palace Hotel was abuzz with internet luminaries. People like Eric Schmidt, Google CEO, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., chairman of the New York Times Company, Mina Trott, co-founder of blogging company Six Apart, Barry Diller, chairman and CEO of IAC Interactive Corporation and chairman of Expedia, Joichi Ito of Technorati and Six Apart Japan, Josh Felser, CEO, Grouper. questions are asked. Questions like, where is this going?
Be free to try out applications that reside in the Web 2.0 space without being faced with getting permission to try things out from the broadband carriers.
There are only a group of people, it's not in the hundreds of thousands, I promise you, and talent outs, and that is the pool that is we're going to depend upon, as we always have, for things that are going to generate to wide audiences.
What dangers lurk?
There's so much hype going on, and I really personally don't like to be a victim of that hype.
You still have to be safe.
But there isn't enough competition, and there isn't any evidence right now that there will be.
Spammers start to target blogs.
And hundreds and hundreds of hours of training, gearing, getting the people together, coordinating, things like this.
Why did the chicken cross the road?
Some of the sounds of Web 2.0, gathered at the Web 2.0 Summit at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco.
It's a 1,000-mile journey in New York City traffic.
I'm Catherine Girardeau, PodTech News.
What about the possibility of getting acquired by the likes of Amazon? Is that in your
No,
your
I don't think so. I'm at Cuba, we're considering buying Amazon. We've been talking about it for a while now, and I think next year or two, Q4 of 2008, maybe.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
We're wont to cross the road. I myself, however, having seen with mine own eyes the road of the Cimmerians, am convinced that the road is not, and never was, crossable by chickens, nor yet by Miskatominos.
Now it's time for another conference. We go to San Jose, California, about an hour away in heavy traffic, for the Dow Jones Venture Wire Consumer Technology Ventures Conference. Matt Kelly says it was 2 days of technology, communications, and entertainment.
The event brought together CEOs from some of the most promising consumer-oriented startups to meet, mingle, and build relationships with the leading investors and entrepreneurs shaping the environment. The two-day program featured an agenda populated with key executives, investors, and analysts, and brought presentations from many of the startups themselves as they sought to capture the attention of venture capitalists to secure possible funding and to introduce themselves to the community at large. One company on hand was Blip TV, co-founder and chief operating officer Dina Kaplan.
I think that what we'll see more and more on the web is sites doing one thing very, very, very well and not trying to be all things to all people. So at Blip.tv, we're great at dealing with video. We can host the video. We can distribute the video throughout the web. We can promote our shows. But we don't need to be the only destination site for video. A lot of our great shows, for example, like Goodnight Burbank, already have an audience going to goodnightburbank.com. The last thing we want to do when and if we bring them over to Blip is siphon off their views to Blip and have them lose their audience. So that's how we're able to have amazing shows like Amanda Congdon, because we will send her videos to amandacongdon.com or Treehugger. Basically, the vision is to bring the videos to wherever the eyeballs are. I mean, look, these shows deserve to go full-time, just as the Seinfeld's Friends, Scrubs, and Desperate Housewives of the world are going full-time. So for the top shows on Blip, we're bringing very high-end sponsors in to attach their brand name with a great consumer brand name that can support them. Look, there's companies like Panasonic that are here that could be great advertisers on Blip, so that's been wonderful to meet them, and happy to talk to people like TV Guide, and it's also interesting to talk to the venture community just to see where they're at in terms of looking at the video sharing market. I think it's an incredibly exciting time for the history of video. And I smile when people say there's so many video sites. Think how many text sites there are that are doing well on the internet. I mean, I guess you could argue that CNN.com is mostly a text site. The Drudge Report is mostly a text site. You have the Huffington Post. You have millions upon millions upon millions of text sites, and many of them are doing very well. If you look at it that way, the number of video sites on the web is actually pretty small right now. So I think what you'll see is a lot of sites will do well in the viral video market. It won't be just YouTube. It could be 10 others that do well in that space, whether it's GoFish, Rever, et cetera, et cetera. I think you'll see a lot of sites do well in the friends and family market, whether it's Motionbox, Clipshack, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think you'll have plenty of sites that'll do well in terms of the video blog market. So there's a lot of room out there, and it's a great time to be in this market.
In addition to startups, big name companies were also present at the conference, including companies such as Panasonic, Google, and NBC Universal, as they sought out potential partners in the gaming, mobile, video sharing, and digital media space. Saab Khanuja is Vice President for Digital Innovation at NBC Universal.
So our focus is basically twofold. One is to grow our existing traditional media properties we have on the digital side, both on the internet and wireless. And two is to also launch standalone digital businesses. So my role is to lead online product initiatives across all the online properties. Given that a lot of the innovation happens in smaller firms and in Silicon Valley, my role is to, you know, keep my NBC hat on and look at all the new technologies and new products coming based on that and see how that can be applied at NBCU. Looked at a company where they allow e-commerce opportunity for users when they are watching TV shows. So how they provide information to the user about, okay, if you're watching Jennifer Aniston, you know, what kind of jacket she is wearing, how you provide that information and how that relates to an action on part of the user in actually going out and buying that. Ultimately, if you can buy that through the same TV, I mean, that's the holy grail. But until we get to that point, you know, how you can do that online and through your wireless. And basically creating new revenue model based on interactivity, which users are increasingly demanding. So that I found pretty interesting. There are a bunch of presentations on video sharing and uploading. You know, that space is really crowded, and to differentiate, you have to come out with some real differentiation in terms of the user experience and the abilities you can provide. There are some gaming presentations I saw, online gaming, which is pretty exciting, wireless. So we all realize that digital media is the next frontier. Very, very exciting. Great to be in this space right now. And if you followed the press on NBCU recently, digital and international have been identified as the two main growth areas going forward, not just to grow overall top line, but also how we can, you know, sort of compensate for the declining revenue on the traditional side. So I'm very excited to be in this space.
In addition, demonstrations were also part of the event, where startups got an opportunity to interact one-on-one with the audience of investors and entrepreneurs and sell the benefits of their product.
My name is John Funge. I'm the CEO of Incanda Corporation. We're the people behind Pickle. Pickle is the best of YouTube and Flickr together, and it works just as well with content from your regular digital camera as well as your mobile phone. I'd say there's probably two things on my agenda here. Is one, to meet other people in the space and learn. And then the other thing is, as well, we're in the process of doing a Series A fundraising round. And so to the extent that we can engage in some conversations with some prospective investors here as well, that's terrific. I take a long view on this, and I sit back and I look out at the 5 to 10 year horizon, and I would, you know, there's a lot of players in the space, a lot of activity, but when you sit back and look at the digitalization of the analog household, it's a gargantuan opportunity that will impact pretty much anyone and everyone that has a digital camera and a broadband internet connection, which is pretty much everybody. And it's something as well, once we get through a lot of the kind of tornado of change that's going on right now, we'll settle down, and there's going to be a family of really, really big companies that come out of this that will have long-standing customer relationships for, you know, for decades with people as they seek to share their memories and preserve their personal media.
Andy Choi, CTO and co-founder of Graystripe. So we're a relatively new company. We've been at this for about a year. The company's been around for 2 years. We basically do in-game mobile advertisements. So we take cell phone games from that other people publish. So we work with around 40 publishers from around the world. Most of their games, you buy them on carrier decks around the world for $5 to $10. But the publishers give us their games for free, and we give them away for free because we have a system that automatically wraps the game with advertisements. And so the simple thing is, you see an ad before the game, an ad after the game, nothing too intrusive. but in return, you get the game for free.
Chris O'Brien, I'm CEO and founder of Motionbox. Motionbox is a personal video sharing service with an emphasis on the personal. We're really focused on individuals who want to share video with their family, friends, and within small groups. We think that the biggest problem for personal video sharing is the raw nature of the video that consumers capture from their digital cameras, mobile phones, and other the new digital devices that are out there. So we've got some new technology on Motionbox to let consumers, when they upload content, very easily find exactly what they want to watch within that. We've got something we call the Filmstrip Player that lets you actually see what's in a video and very rapidly jump to a section. Once you find a piece of a video file, maybe it's a skiing jump or something interesting that happens within a soccer game, you can actually select a piece of that video just as if it were text in a web processor, in a web browser, and then save that specific section with somebody, tag that specific section, or post that section to your MySpace page. I think what people have really responded to with Motionbox is the idea that, you know, we've all talked about home movies are really hard to watch, but they're hard to watch because you have to watch them linearly if you take a tape and you put it into your VCR. And if you think about all the web video players out there today, you've got a play button and a pause button, a very limited user interface. It's real hard to watch 15 minutes of somebody's raw video from a digital camera that way. With Motionbox, you don't have to. You can very quickly scan through 15 minutes of video, see what's inside of it in far less than a minute, and again, jump right to the section that you want. And soon we'll be launching the ability for you to combine those sections together in a new mixing technology we'll be launching in just a few weeks. We've got great backers, including Itochu Corporation, SAS Investors, and Kane & Partners. But we're really here just to get the word out about Motionbox. This is a great forum to reach not only investors, but also lots of the journalists who are here and many potential partners through whom we can get distribution for Motionbox.
Jason Grimm, VP of Marketing, Innovation Labs. Interaction Labs. We were Power Grid Technologies, and before that, we were Power Grid Fitness. The company was founded for a technology we have that translates user force into data that can be read by a computer as a standard gamepad. The advantage to that is the user gets a workout by playing video games or just using their computer. So when the company started, it was a fitness company. We then found that the technology, which we call IsoCore, had so many different applications that it was no longer just a fitness application, but rather a technology application. Our primary goal is for VC funding. In fact, Best Buy, Fry's, Sharper Image, Target, they've all committed to placing our consumer product. We just don't have the money to build it. 3 years in a row, we won the Innovation for Gaming Technologies at the Consumer Electronics Show, 04, 05, and 06 for our technology. Well, it's a great way to have your voice heard. A lot of like-minded individuals, very targeted. It's also nice for us to see what other trends are and other ways we can cooperate with companies that are maybe working in the same space, maybe not. But you have key players from major industries here. It's really cutting edge. I love listening to the presentations, and again, it's a great way for us to get our voice out there. As I look around, I see technologies even I didn't know existed. And to hear some of the major players like Robbie Bach speak, just amazing for us.
Now in its 11th year, the event has become a destination of choice among startups to get noticed and hopefully reach new heights. Last year, Grouper Networks presented at the Consumer Technology Ventures Conference, and this past August was purchased by Sony Pictures Entertainment for $65 million. I'm Matt Kelly reporting.
So what would you give up to get a little bit extra time around the holiday season? One new study got some surprising responses to that question. Michael Klinger has these surprising remarks about the marketing stat of the week.
People are always complaining that they don't have enough time. Then the holidays roll around and there's shopping or going to parties or cleaning up after parties, and time becomes even more valuable. Finally, a study has stepped up and asked the tough question, what would you give to get a little more time for yourself? The study from the hard-hitting fact finders at shopping.com says a lot, even without saying too much. It seems 35% of respondents would be happy to give up alcohol in exchange for three-day weekends all year long. I always thought the purpose of the three-day weekend had something to do with the involvement of alcohol, but I could be wrong. 29% said they would go without junk food for those long weekends, 3 days without potato chips every week, but they would have booze, but not pretzels. The study didn't stop there. fruitcakes are going straight to the trash bin, say an overwhelming 47%, and the official start of the holiday shopping season begins now for about 46% of respondents. 22% think the day after Thanksgiving sounds like a good time to hit the stores. With so many people willing to give up food and drink and so many others willing to spend the entire month of December in parking lots and malls, it looks like the 20% of self-identified last-minute shoppers who won't give up anything and won't spend a whole month shopping may be onto something. With the marketing stat, I'm Michael Klinger.
The countdown is on, 7 days until the Sony PlayStation 3 is finally released to the masses. Will the PS3, with its HD graphics, Blu-ray player, and six-axis controller live up to the hype? PodTech's Rio Pacino attempts to answer that question in this podcast on the top reasons to buy or not to buy a PlayStation 3.
We're less than 2 weeks away from the release of the Sony PlayStation 3 and the Nintendo Wii, probably one of the most anticipated launches in video game history. Those who've reserved their systems at a local EB or GameStop are pretty relaxed right now as they're just about guaranteed a system. However, there are those out there who'll probably be sleeping overnight in front of their local game store, hoping, just hoping to get a shot at purchasing a PlayStation 3 or a Nintendo Wii. Now, to honor this momentous video game occasion, we are actually doing a number of feature podcasts and listing the reasons to or not to buy either the Sony PlayStation 3, the Nintendo Wii, or the already released Xbox 360. Last week we covered the Wii. This week we're covering the PlayStation 3. I spoke with GamePro Magazine and GamePro.com news editor Sid Schumann about the PlayStation 3, its pros and cons, and how it will fare in the next-gen console war.
Well, it's really interesting. I think the PlayStation 3 had a lot of bad press this year. It was kind of interesting how at E3 they announced the price point, $499, $599. Everyone kind of let out this gasp. Mm-hmm. I wasn't at the press conference, but my colleagues were, and they said the room just felt utterly silent when they did that. And then they whipped out the new controller, which you
the
know,
boomerang controller.
That's
at
right.
First.
Now it looks like a DualShock from PS2. It's the same thing, and the only thing that's really different about it is that it has this sort of motion sensing ability. And then so they're throwing out some of the fanboys are throwing out some accusations that they had ripped off Nintendo for the Wii and the right. motion sensing and so on and so forth. When I was in Tokyo just a few weeks ago for the Tokyo Game Show, you could sense a real sort of shift in attitude, I think, among a lot of the media types and the reporters and everything. They had Sony had this great demo set up with, you know, pretty much every first party game, some of the third party titles, and you could play them all, and a lot of them in 1080p. And I'll tell you, a lot of the games looked damn good. And that was something that was sort of the missing X factor, I think, for Sony, was that they weren't really showing these games. You know, the right. games are very secretive. There's a lot of concern about, you know, did the developers have enough time to work on
a lot of
the
early footage that we saw of the PS3, they were all CG.
CG, and you know, everyone at first, you know, when they showed Killzone 2 a couple E3s ago, everyone went nuts, and then they were like, wait a minute, this is obviously CG. Right. No games are going to look that good, you know. But it's funny because I'll tell you, some of these games look really good. MotorStorm looks phenomenal. Lair has just sparkling graphics. Although the Xbox 360 is a very powerful system, I would not say that it's deficient in any way in the graphics category. It's a very robust system in terms of graphics. Nothing to be ashamed of there. I think the PS3 has an edge. Microsoft has really bent over backwards to say how the dual-layer DVD format is just fine for Xbox 360. You know, they don't have to compromise. That's all the space anybody needs, so on and so forth. But, you know, I was playing through Gears of War the other day, and I noticed...
That's one of the most anticipated games of the
that
year.
That is the top game. This is the game that Microsoft
besides
is...
Besides Halo 3.
Besides Halo 3, which who knows when that's coming out.
Right.
But for 2006, the game is Gears of War, and mm-hmm. it is a great game, but you can see some aggressive compression being used in some of the cinemas. So, which is kind of interesting because I think it kind of neutralizes a little bit of Microsoft's argument that, you don't need Blu-ray, you don't need all these fancy new formats, we're just fine where we're at. And I thought, you know, boy, Gears of War looks phenomenal, but these cinemas, if you look, you can see some serious compression being done. And right. that says to me that they almost ran out of space. PS3 stuff I've seen has been sparkling for the most part. I mean, you have some games that just kind of look so-so, you know, right. You tell that
one English, of the games was NBA 07. That was terrible. But like you said, there are other games that are out there that look beautiful.
They look great.
Gran Turismo HD looks fantastic.
I would even put that in the middle of the list. Ridge Racer 7 looks really good. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, the standouts are clearly MotorStorm and Lair. You can see there's something a little bit different going on the PS3, just a little. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's Blu-ray and that they have this ability to, you know, to render these textures and to render these graphics that have no compromises and they don't have to compress them down and sort of simplify them, or if it's, I think personally, it's a cell processor.
Sony's decision to mm-hmm. include a Blu-ray player with the Sony PlayStation 3, do you think that's more of a positive or a reason maybe not to buy it? Because, I mean, the price tag was obviously kicked up a bit because of the Blu-ray technology.
I think gamers and everybody, media types, reporters, I think everybody has lots of reasons to question Sony's motives for putting Blu-ray in there. To my eyes, it's fairly obvious that they did it as sort of a Trojan horse strategy to get Blu-ray out there so that they knew they had an install base they could count on so they could make money off movies. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think it's unethical. But I think that's a key reason why they did that. On the other hand, though, when you're hearing about Resistance Fall of Man using 22 gigs, which right. is almost maxing out a single layer
of...
That's
25.
Gig, you have to go to dual layer then to get 50, and you can go the whole way up to, I think, 200 mm-hmm. gigs if they start doing really multi-layer stuff. To me, and then seeing things like Gears of War, and I'm just getting this sense, I don't know how else to describe, I'm getting this sense, though, that developers really would like quite a bit of storage, as much as they can possibly get. I am beginning to think that Blu-ray is going to be a serious strength for Sony. It's going to hurt them in the beginning. The prices are going to be high. So I think in the long run, I think in year two, year three, maybe year four, you're going to see PS3 get a traction. I bet we'll have more lasting impact than Xbox 360 or maybe even Wii.
1080p, mm-hmm. HDMI. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. To other people, that may not be a big deal. Mm-hmm. But do you see that being as a positive for Sony as well?
Yeah, it's interesting. 1080p is definitely going to be a positive point for Sony. HDMI is really going to be a positive point for Sony. Nice thing about HDMI is it's super high-res digital video and audio in one connector. So that's just great. You have one cable that handles everything. And now it's in both of the PS3s. You know, you're going to get it in the cheap one and the pricey one.
Sony's known for their backward compatibility, you know, with the PS2, being able to play PlayStation 1 games on it. PlayStation 3 offers that as well, something mm-hmm. that Xbox 360 owners have had trouble with. That has to be a plus for Sony as well, being able to play PlayStation 2 and PS1 games on the PS3.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My understanding is that PS3 will have all but perfect support for every PlayStation and PlayStation 2 game. The only downside is that to do that, they actually kind of embedded a miniature PS2 inside the PS3. Which adds to the cost, it adds to the weight, it adds to the heat. It kind of is not exactly I don't know if I would say it's a super elegant, it's not the ideal solution. It also means that Phil Harrison from Sony's confirmed this too, that when you play a PlayStation 1 or a PlayStation 2 game on your PS3, you're not going to be able to do fun stuff like, you know, upsample it to 1080 or just sort of, you know, it's going to be a straightforward as is. There's not going to be any real additional benefits. Now, maybe that's something they'll be able to add through downloads. I really hope they do. That's just a really nice perk.
What are some other positives that you found with the PS3?
I mean, I think there's really something to be said for what Sony is doing with the motion sensing controller on the PS3. I've tried it a couple times. I used it in Lair, you know, which is a game where you ride a dragon around. So you tilt the controller to the left to bank left, you tilt it to the right to bank right, you know, you sort of shoot it down, you know, to plunge. And once you get the hang of it, which takes about 2 minutes, it's actually really good. It's pretty intuitive. I could see that being for racing games, too. But I think it's a key advantage for them because I think PS3, in a sense, is going to be this halfway house between Wii and Xbox 360. But Sony at least pushed something on the controller. They lost Rumble, which I feel convinced in the next year or two they're going to come, you know, they're going to strike a deal with Immersion. I think they probably will end up adding it back. Although who knows, you know,
It's you mentioned the Wii controller being a gimmick. Why not say the same about the six axis?
You know, it's funny because I think the whole central point of the Wii controller is its motion sensing. The PS3 six axis has motion sensing. But like, let's say it doesn't work out. Oh, well, you still have a proven controller to fall back on with decent analog sticks. You know, yeah, I think Xbox 360 probably has better analog sticks. And yeah, I think I like the triggers a little better on the Xbox 360. But the Wii, I mean, let's say that this motion sensing thing is very problematic and it's flaky and, you know, there's just problems with it. Well, that's all she wrote because the whole system's founded on that. There's no fallback. That is the system. The system is the motion sensing. Sony PS3 controller, it's this additional feature. Right. So they have a solid, you know, time-tested controller that will still be very useful in its own way.
The option to use a flash, compact flash, SD, or even a memory stick, I thought that was pretty cool as well.
That's actually a nice feature. I mean, Microsoft could have easily done that for their memory cards, but what did they do? They went proprietary because they want to get that extra little bit of cash off memory card sales. Mm-hmm. Well, who cares? I mean, that's silly. I think that's the old way of thinking.
I think that was pretty good of Sony to do that, so we don't have to buy more Sony products.
You know, no, they'll sell. I'm sure they'll sell. I think I already saw they're going to sell, you know, Sony-branded memory sticks and stuff, which is fine, and a lot of people will go buy those, and they'll make their money, but you have this option of using your own. Why not? You know?
Sid, let's go ahead and touch on some of the negatives with the PlayStation 3. First thing that comes to mind for me is the size of the console. It's huge.
It is big. There's no doubt about it. I've touched it. I've looked at it quite a bit. I've been, you know, hands-on with it many times. If you stick a PS3 next to an Xbox 360, and again, I am not knocking Xbox 360. You know, I quite a few games on it. I love to play it. I love Xbox Live. But if you put an Xbox 360 next to a PS3, you know, and ask just a random person on the street which one they think looks better, it is a phenomenal-looking system. It looks like sex. I mean, it looks like sex. It is something that you would want to have in your living room. It is big, and it's heavy, and it's the biggest and the heaviest of the consoles. But it also does the most.
Right.
So in my mind, you know, yeah, would I like to see one that's half the size? Absolutely. Do I see it as a giant negative? Not so much, unless you're the kind of guy or gal that likes to throw your console into a book bag and run over your friend's house, in which case... Yep. Xbox 360 and PS3 are pretty much out, and you should get a Wii, probably.
And I'm one of those people who do that.
Mm-hmm. That's the only downside.
Bring my system on the go, so.
That's a downside, I agree.
What other negatives have you seen with the PS3?
Well, the first one that comes to my mind is obviously the price. I mean, you know, you're talking $500 and $600. Yeah, the price, it's kind of a shame, and that comes back to the Blu-ray question. I mean, should they have put Blu-ray in there? I don't know. I mean, that's what jacked the price up, you know. The hard drive also jacks the price up a lot.
What are your thoughts on their online service? And besides Blast Factor and a few of the games that they've announced, you haven't heard much about it.
No, I have to agree that Sony needs to get their act together with online. I mean, they've shown, you know, in a couple cases, okay, you know, hey, we have this friends list and here it is. And it looks kind of cool. That looks fine. But what they needed to do was they really needed, and maybe it was a financial reason they didn't do this, but I think what they needed to do is simply say, Xbox Live, that's really good. Let's just do our version of Xbox Live.
One last thing. I know this is a pretty petty negative for some people, but in my mind, it's actually pretty important, was the lack of an HDMI cable.
Oh, no HDMI cable in the system. Yeah.
Why not include that when, I mean, that's one of the key features of the system.
You know, the one that makes me cry even harder than that is that there won't even be a component cable.
Yeah.
It's composite.
Come on.
That's the old yellow jack that your grandma's TV takes, you know what I mean? I mean, why not throw an RF unit in there while you're at it, you know? I mean, it's funny that they're pitching this, you know, this mega HD experience, and they're throwing these crummy cables in with it. I'm with you on that. I mean, when you're paying $600, the least they could have done was throwing component cables and HDMI cables in with the pricier one. Mm-hmm. To me, that would have at least, that would have made me feel a little better. As far as out-of-the-box experience goes, 480i over a composite cable is not exactly what I expect when I pay $500 or $600 for a game console.
Anything else come to mind as far as negatives with the system?
One other negative, potential negative, is some games are going to have these install procedures on PS3. This is something I've never seen on Xbox 360, where you're going to be able to install a game to get better performance on the hard drive. Ridge Racer 7 is going to let you do that. It's going to take up 4 or 5 gigs on your hard drive, and it'll have super fast loading times and stuff. Sony's definitely doing some interesting things with how they're sort of positioning the PS3 too. It's you know, in keeping with that, the sort of install procedure for games. It sounds like it's only some games right now. Maybe, who knows, maybe it'll be all of them later. But it really looks like they're turning it into almost like a PC where actually Ken Kutaragi told a Japanese newspaper a little while ago that oh, who knows, you know, maybe we'll have Blu-ray burners, maybe we'll, you know, do that, or maybe we'll allow you to upgrade your RAM and all these other things. It's kind of odd. I'm kind of curious to see where they go with that.
Right.
It sounds hard to believe on one level, but, you know, Ken Kutaragi said it. So I asked Sony's Phil Harrison about that, too, at Tokyo Game Show, and he said, you know, can't comment on the hardware strategy, but I can tell you the software will keep getting better. So there's still so many unanswered questions, you know, I think.
Yeah, you would expect more information to be out there by now.
Yeah, they've been getting better about it. A couple weeks ago, they definitely shared a lot more details, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I think it's going to be shaping up to be one of the biggest next-gen battles of all time, probably the biggest.
That was GamePro News editor Sid Schumann talking about the pros and cons of the PS3. For PodTech News, I'm Rio Pacino.
That's PodTech News Weekly Magazine, produced by Michael Klinger, Rio Pacino, Clark Boyd, Catherine Girardeau, and Matt Kelly. I'm Jason Lopez.